Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we feature an interesting summertime read that combines the maker movement, craft, environmentalism, conservation, history, and economics into a single tree. British writer Robert Penn writes a social history into his exploration into everything made from a single felled ash tree in his book, The Man Who Made Things Out of Trees. From this single large tree he logged near his home, Penn worked with artisans, artists, designers, and woodworkers to create hundreds of items from that single tree, including a writing desk and chair, a toboggan, kitchen utensils and bowls, a canoe paddle, a meat carving board, a set of dominoes, custom bicycle rims for a 19th century bicycle restorer, a wheel for the roof of a yurt, surfboard components, and much more. The list goes on and on, literally hundreds of items. Each item tells a story and history of crafts that are dying out, others that are reviving, and also the movement to make things by hand. He also tells the story of this tree, the ash tree. In the Middle Ages, it was used for joists and beams. On farms, it was used to make plows and handles for all sorts of common tools. Coopers liked it for the hoops on their cask. Ash has been used to make paddles for about 6,000 years, and of course it's perhaps most famous in this country as the wood of choice for baseball bats. And at least in this country, the future of the tree is threatened by a tiny bug, the emerald tree borer. Writer Robert Penn is my guest today. Robert Penn, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Lovely to talk to you.
This book, The Man Who Made Things of Trees, it sounds like it was a really interesting journey. And what led you on this journey to learn more about the common ash white tree?
I mean, I grew up under an ash tree quite a long time ago, and it was the tree that led from my childhood garden to the fields where my brother and I played, and somehow that tree figured very strongly in my imagination when I was growing up. And ultimately, you know, 25, 30 years later, I ended up moving to a part of the United Kingdom called the Brecon Beacons in southeast Wales, which is a landscape which looks very similar to that which I knew as a child, and is a place which is also very heavily accented with woodlands, and those woodlands are very heavily accented with the ash tree. And when I moved here over a decade ago, I got myself involved in woodland management. I own a small piece of woodland, and slowly but surely I came to understand that the ash tree was a very important tree formally to us as a species, and it was entwined with the human story, or the story of human civilization. And as I began to read and learn more about it, my affection for it increased, and then I realized that actually there was an incredible story here, a story which really goes to the root of what it means to be human.
So how did this project begin? Did it begin with the idea of seeing what you can make out of a single ash tree, or was it about learning about the ash tree, or what exactly?
The more I read about the ash tree, the more I came to understand that it had previously been invaluable to us, up until really relatively recently, certainly within living memory. So where I live is a very rural area, and talking to the old farmers, the farmers into their 80s, about the ash, I came to realize that they had depended upon it as farmers for all of their working lives. And that led me to read more and more about it, and I came to understand that there was this incredible story here. And then I wanted to tell that story, to tell it in a book and to tell it in the talks that I give and various other means. I work as a journalist, and was then looking for a narrative, a sort of vehicle that would allow me to tell the story of ash. And I realized fairly quickly that a very simple way to do it, in a way that would lead me into lots of other subsidiary stories, was to fell one ash tree, a single ash tree that grew near here, near my home, and have that made into as many things as I possibly could by artisans and craftsmen and women who were local to the area. And that, I thought, was a sort of very easy vehicle for relating the historical value of the ash tree, and at the same time, in trying to use all of one tree, in trying to use every bit of it, I wanted to exalt the worth of a single tree.
And the amount of material, of finished products that you made out of this one tree was truly amazing.
Yeah, well, it was quite extraordinary. So I got 44 different uses out of the one tree. Actually, that, you know, the number of individual items runs to hundreds. So I got a desk made, the desk at which I ultimately sat down to write the book. I got spoons and spatulas, a coffee table, a triangle chair, cricket stumps, a canoe paddle, catapults, arrow shafts. I used the sawdust for smoking fish. I made some charcoal from some of the branch wood. There was some firewood, spoons. I mean, it goes on and on. And I didn't write extensively about all of those different uses. I just chose the ones that were made by the most interesting artisans and craftspeople. And I wrote extensively about the artifacts that really went to the story of, to the heart of the story of man's relationship with this extraordinary tree.
Well, in choosing a tree, you found that a lot of thought went into actually felling that single tree, wasn't there?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So once I started to look for my tree, I came to think about trees in a rather different way, because from my reading and from talking to timber experts and from talking to artisans, I came to understand that there were lots of different properties in a single tree, and different aspects of different trees offer different sorts of timber with which, you know, you can make very different things. So I wanted basically a very straight stem or trunk of a tree with very few side branches. And what that means is you have clean timber without lots of knots. And that's what people who want to maximize the strength properties of ash would like to use. So for tool handles, for example, or tent pegs, or catapults, or components of surfboards, that is the sort of timber that they wanted. But then above that, above the stem, you have what's called the spring of the crown, and above the spring of the crown, you have the canopy of the tree. And how the canopy has grown, and the circumstances in which it has grown, and how much sunlight it has had, and how many close neighbors it's had in the woodland, determine what sort of multi-structured timber you get. So after, you know, thinking it would be incredibly easy to find an ash tree to fell, the more I learned, the harder it got, basically. In the end, it took an exhaustive search to find the tree that offered me the maximum amount of variety that a single ash tree could offer.
And what you also found along the process, which was, it sort of strikes Americans as different, because we think of commercial logging,
yep,
where, you know, it's very indiscriminate. But when you're looking at a hardwood tree like this, where you want to make a variety of products, the search is exhaustive for that single tree. And what I found is, like, every artisan that was talking about was, says, okay, so what did you do? Did you plant a new tree? Did you do something to replace this tree? What I found really interesting was how many people, everybody from the sawmill owner down, were concerned that you were replenishing the supply from taking this tree out of production.
I think that's absolutely right. And to me, that was great. I mean, I was very pleased that people were interested in what I was doing. You know, our timber as a global resource is sustainable if we use it in a sustainable way. You know, that starts with forestry on a grand scale, as you in America will know, and it goes all the way down to managing a tiny, tiny woodlot which is connected to a farm. If you regenerate, allow the woodland to regenerate, or plant in a way that replenishes the forest as you use it, then it's going to be there for the next generation and the generation after that and the one after that. And that kind of goes really to the sort of heart of the story. So what I was trying to do was write a book about the value of a single tree, and thereby write a book about the value of all of our trees, and encourage people to think about them as a valuable resource, which, if we manage sustainably, will be there for us indefinitely.
Now, ash over the years has been used everything from joists for middle-aged buildings to, you mentioned, used on the farm. It was basically the wood that provided the handle for nearly all the tools a farmer would use.
Yeah.
It provided most of the tool handles for any sort of a blacksmith or industrial worker, what we would consider an industrial worker. What is it about this particular wood that makes it so valuable?
I think there's a number of aspects of it. So one, it's widely available, okay, which, you know, several thousand years ago made it valuable in its own way, just because it was widely available. For us, in Europe, it grows in many, many locations, most locations even. But then over and above that, it has mechanical properties, you know, what material scientists would call mechanical properties, that distinguish it from almost all other tree species, certainly European tree species. And that meant that Neolithic carpenters 4,000 years ago preferentially used it for the handles of axes. And we know this from the archaeological evidence such as it exists across Europe. And they preferentially used it because it broke less. You know, that's why they preferentially used it. And now we understand that it has all sorts of interesting mechanical properties, which, as I say, distinguish it. And central to those is a property of, to use a commonplace word rather than a scientific word, elasticity. Ash has greater capacity to bend and then to regain its original shape after it's been bent. And it has that property in a greater way than almost any other timber species anywhere in the world. Now, hickory is one that you have in America, which is on a par with it. But over here, hickory doesn't grow in Europe. So we've never had the benefit of hickory, so we've always used ash for anything that you need, you know, elastic properties for.
And interesting, even when you have hickory supplies nearby, a lot of toolmakers and the people that do use ash prefer it over hickory, though.
So that is partly because it's lighter. You know, and I wrote a chapter about in the book about the baseball bat.
Yes.
You know, hickory was popular in the manufacture of baseball bats at the beginning of the 20th century and then drifted out of fashion when the batters wanted lighter bats from the kind of 1920s, 1930s onwards. And that meant, you know, that ash was preferentially used for baseball bats all the way through from the 1930s until the 1990s it became. And it was really the same thing for tool handles. So if you wanted a tool handle that was good to handle, I mean, there are other properties it has. It's very easy. It's very kind on the human hand. And so if you have it and your axe handle or your shovel handle or your spade handle, the more you use it, the smoother it gets. Now, lots of woods don't do that. In fact, they go the opposite way. The more you use them, the rougher they get, and the more likely they are to splinter and put tiny parts of wood into your hands. But ash is very kind on the human hand. So a combination of availability, elasticity, kind on the human hand, and it also has, and this is something that woodworkers talk about all the time, it has really good working properties. So if you think that, you know, most of human carpentry was done before we had machine tools to shape wood, you had to do it with hand tools, you know, as the Neolithic carpenters did, as wheelwrights in ancient Egypt did. They all used hand tools right up until relatively recently. And ash has really great workability. It's a sort of rather curious word, but that's a word that woodworkers use. It has really good workability, so it's easy to get it to the sort of size that you want to make an axe handle, for example, just by splitting it with hand tools. And then once you've got it down, it shaves very well, and then it smooths off very well.
My guest today is Robert Penn, author and journalist, and the man who wrote The Man Who Made Things of Trees. It's published by Norton. This book talks about felling a single white ash tree and making as much product, many things out of that one tree as he could. In fact, there was virtually no wastage of this tree. And in the course of making these objects, he tells the story of how this particular wood has influenced human history. And it's a fascinating book. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Speaking of wheelwrights, as you did just a moment ago, that's one of the first stories you tell, making axe handles and wheelwrights. And what was really interesting to me was, wow, there are still wheelwrights today.
Yes, I know. It's amazing, isn't it? So in the great census of Great Britain and Ireland that was conducted in 1911 before the First World War, there were 23,000 plus wheelwrights working in Great Britain at that time. And there are basically six now. And there are a few others who are doing it part-time, but there are six who are doing it properly and genuinely making a living from it. I went to see this chap called Phil Gregson on the coast of northwest England, and he's a wheelwright. Obviously, his father was a wheelwright. Mother was a wheelwright, interestingly. And his grandfather, who's still around, and I had the pleasure to meet, was also a wheelwright. And in spending time with him, it was fascinating, really, because by the time I got to him, even though it's sort of fairly early in this project, I'd done an awful lot of research, and I thought I'd read pretty much everything that I could find, you know, on the internet and in books and in the British Library about ash and about how we'd used ash and about the properties of it. And yet, spending time with him, I came to realize that so much of what he knew is not written down anywhere. You know, it was a knowledge of and an empathy for and an understanding of the properties of ash that was simply extraordinary. And as I say, it's knowledge that's not written down anywhere. It's stuff which has been passed from father to son or master to apprentice over eons.
Would you say that that's the case with a lot of the artisans you spoke with? I mean,
yes,
they had a sort of essential nature of working with this wood that isn't written down.
That's right. And, you know, it's nuanced material, very, very subtle understanding of particular properties of not just a species of wood, but the different bits of wood within the same plank, for example. So he could look at a plank of wood which is an inch deep and, you know, 2 foot wide and 12 foot long and tell you about the different properties or different strength properties of that single piece of wood and how they varied throughout just that one board. And, you know, the other thing that spending time with this wheelwright was it's I'd read all the books, or a number of books about wheelwrighting by the time I came to meet Bill. And what I realized, almost as soon as he started making a wheel in front of me, was that what he was doing was making a wooden wheel pretty much in the same way that Egyptian carpenters made wooden wheels for their military chariots 4,000 years ago, or 3,500 years ago. And that continuity in the way that, you know, natural materials were, command of natural materials was mastered for the benefit of us, man, as a species, that continuity is something incredible. You know, we live in an age where so much change is going on now, partly because it's all principally because of technology, but other reasons as well. This mantra of the age seems to be change. And we know we demand new things all of the time. And actually, so much of what is brilliant about human beings actually lies in the continuity.
I also found that with one of the first stories is about a guy who makes axe handles. And I guess they still use ash, but they're using other woods now as well.
Yes, they are. So for all sorts of reasons, you know, the availability, the price, you know, they started using other types of wood. I mean, nowadays you can go to a hardware store and buy an axe which has got a plastic handle. Goodness knows why you'd want one. But, you know, that's what people do. You can even buy axes with, you know, you certainly buy spades with metal handles, and I think you can buy axes with carbon handles. I mean, it sounds absurd, really, doesn't it? Yeah, we're in a race to provide new man-made materials, but actually we've got really outstanding natural materials which are available to us. But it was lovely spending time with the tool handler manufacturer. So one of the tools of man which has changed least over the course of human history is the axe handle, a beautifully modulated, elegantly balanced piece of equipment for us to use. You know, so somehow fits the simian grip of the human hand. It's a masterful thing, a well-made axe handle. And, you know, I spent time at this very small tool handle manufacturer, exclusively wooden tool handle manufacturer in South Wales, the last exclusively wooden tool handle manufacturer in the United Kingdom. And spending time particularly with one of the employees, he'd been working there for 40 years, and his boss told me as an aside that he thought this particular employee probably carried out 200 quality checks on a piece of wood as it passed through the factory, the beginning of the process to the tool handles being packaged up and sent out to somebody. And what I, you know, realized was that you could put this particular man in, you know, in a time-traveling vehicle and deposit him at any point of human history, from the beginning of civilization in ancient Mesopotamia until now, 21st century, and he would get employment.
Right. Well, and that's the other thing, is that a lot of times these artisans you're talking to, will there be another generation of artisans like this? You mentioned Hillerich and Bradsby, which makes Louisville Sluggers. You actually came over to the United States to visit the process for making baseball bats, which ash is still considered one of the premium woods for their other woods now being made, but really it's the classic standard. And, you know, the guy that makes the bespoke Major League Baseball bats, I mean, will there be another generation like that? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, I sort of wish I did know the answer to that, but I don't. I mean, the interesting thing about baseball is that if you allow the bat to change, so if you allow Major League Baseball to be played with a metal bat or an aluminium bat or a ceramic bat, bat made out of any other man-made material, the entire nature of the game changes. And the introduction of aluminium bats has, you know, made this the case for other forms of baseball. But it means that the nature of the game changes, and also the history of the game. So all the incredible statistics that represent this amazing body of the history of baseball, they become irrelevant. And that is why I think, you know, the leadership of the game, you know, the rule makers continue to insist that only wooden bats can be used. And for me, I think that's great because it's, you know, it means that the history of the game remains relevant. Otherwise, you just have to start again. But then there are other, you know, well, sporting artifacts. I mean, it's quite interesting the part that ash has played in sport because of the elastic properties, which I mentioned earlier, is huge. So up until the 1980s, tennis rackets were made from ash. And I'm old enough to remember the Dunlop Max by tennis racket, which is made of several different species of wood, but principally ash. Ash tennis rackets, real tennis rackets, were made in France back in the 15th century. So, you know, ash has played an incredibly important part in sport, and it is often said by lawn tennis aficionados that the greatest Wimbledon final ever played was between McEnroe and Borg in 1980, and that is, you know, the last ever wooden racket final where both players played with wooden rackets. And the nature of the game of tennis has changed a lot, you know, because the subtlety and a lot of the guile and the subtlety has gone out of the game.
It's become a power game, yeah, right. Yeah, because of the they hit it much harder because of the aluminum and lightweight metals. Yeah. And you said you were taken somewhat aback that Major League Baseball would say, no, we're not going to switch away from wooden bats. You said that was kind of surprising to you.
Well, it was surprising in as much as, you know, the United States has kind of led the planet in scientific development, in finding man a role in space and understanding space, in the technological revolution which has swept over the planet in the last 20 years. America has led in, you know, all of these sort of great steps for mankind.
Well, and you're also sort of talking about that very un-British quality of chucking tradition.
Yes, that's right, the very un-British quality, exactly, yeah. And so I was very surprised when I discovered that the rule makers of the game insist that Major League game has to be played with a wooden bat. You know, I would have thought that Americans, that of all people, would embrace the new and the dynamism of change.
My guest today is Robert Penn. His new book is titled The Man Who Made Things Out of Trees. It's published by Norton. It tells about his journey of felling a single white ash tree in Wales and making as many products and learning about those products and in turn our history through that process. I want to talk about a couple of the fine pieces that you did. You talked a little bit about your desk, but tell us a little bit more about your desk and the toboggan you made, which that sounds like, you know, a great piece of craftsmanship as well.
So the toboggan is one of the other properties of ash, which is not unique, but is very well represented in ash species, is the fact that it steam bends very well. So Native Americans understood this, so they used ash for their snowshoes, steam bending it, you know, a century, millennia ago. And ash was, we think, you know, there isn't a huge amount of archaeological evidence to suggest it, but we think it was used for toboggans and sledges because, again, it steam bent very well for the runners of a toboggan or a sledge. So Roald Amundsen, the Norwegian explorer, who was the first person to reach the South Pole in 1911, his sledges were constructed of ash, had ash runners. And, you know, there's a company in Britain today that still makes toboggans, Arctic and Antarctic exploration toboggans out of ash with ash runners. And there is a small but thriving industry in the Alps, in the European Alps, making toboggans. And actually, because the cost of skiing has gone up in the last two or three decades, making it unaffordable for lots of local people in the Alps, tobogganing has come back into fashion. So these businesses are doing very, very well again. So I rang this lovely chap up. He runs, he's called Christian Gasser and runs a company called Gasser Rodel in the Südtirol in Austria. I rang him up and said, could I bring a piece of my ash to you across Europe on train, and could you then make it into a toboggan for me? And I think it was probably one of the more obscure requests he'd ever had in his lifetime making toboggans. But he agreed, and so I took some of my ash across and, you know, went through the entire process of making a toboggan with him, which was just delightful. He was the most enchanting man. It's a family business. So lots of these businesses, interestingly, lots of the artisans I used came out of businesses or worked in a family tradition that goes back a generation or two generations, sometimes three generations, of using ash in some way. So lots of them made axe handles formerly. Some of them were wheelwrights, and they'd evolved into other types of businesses. And in Christian's case, his great uncle had set up a business making wheels for wooden carts going over the Brenner Pass from Austria into Italy. And then that had evolved into a toboggan manufacturing business, which is today thriving.
Well, it was amazing how many products you got out of there. I mean, everything from benches to coat racks to cutting boards to bicycle wheel rims. Somebody wanted wooden bicycle wheel rims to a set of dominoes. And I guess you had people coming to you once they heard about this tree to say, I could use a little wood for my particular product, which involves a wheel for a roof of a yurt.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. Martin got in touch with me. So people did. So the more artisans I met, you know, the more the word got out that I had this large amount of timber. So there were probably 4 tons. Is that the metric ton I'm using there?
Yeah.
Four metric tons of timber.
Wow.
About the entire tree for me to use. And some of that I left in the wood to rot down, to return to the earth as humus, which is, you know, part of the, part of a sustainable woodland management program. So I left some of the wood there, but, you know, the majority of it, maybe 3/4 of it, came out of the wood. And so the more artisans I met, the more people found out about the project, and the more people rang me up and said, I hear you've got some ash, can I come and take some? So fishing landing nets. Someone used a bit and steam bent it to be made into a fishing landing net. This chap called Martin rang me, said, I need a bit for the wheel in the roof of a yurt. And then he took a bit away, and then a little bit that was left over, he turned into the barrel of an ink pen, which he sent back to me as a gift to say thanks very much, which was absolutely charming. But yes, kitchen worktops, paneling, you know, nesting bowls, porridge spoons, benches, as you mentioned. You know, and then bits of it we used for animal bedding, some of the sawdust that came off the various, you know, chainsaws and mills that timber was milled on, I bagged up and gave to a friend of mine to use to smoke meat and fish.
Yeah. Robert Penn, thank you very much for joining us. It's a fascinating look into this great story.
It's been a pleasure.
British writer and television presenter Robert Penn speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled The Man Who Made Things Out of Trees. It's published by Norton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.